For 8 years, Sherry Ballard has been an outspoken advocate for her family. At rallies and court dates, searches and somber anniversaries, she has always used her voice to keep her daughter and husband's names top of mind. I've done dozens of interviews with Sherry over the last decade, so it was different when she told me for the first time she had to stay quiet. The prosecutor and detectives didn't want her doing any interviews after the arrests in her daughter's case, and she respected that. Until the 7-year mark of her husband's case rolled around, a case that is still unsolved. Sherry decided then she couldn't and wouldn't keep quiet. I'm Shay McAllister, and this is Bardstown. Wheels don't fail me now. Let's get out of here somehow. What do you think, Sherry? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. I met Sherry at her house right outside of Bardstown. It was a nice November day, so we decided to take advantage of the sunshine and set up 2 chairs in her backyard. Sherry still lives in the same house she shared with her husband, Tommy, the house he built for their family. The memories can be painful, but now they're all she has. She remembers standing in the kitchen with her husband, watching leaves fall from the big tree right outside the window. It was an annual autumn tradition for them, something they shared. We sat under that tree as I started asking her about her husband and the years that have passed since she last saw him. Leaves floated down around our chairs as we started the conversation. Can you believe it's been 7 years?
When all of this first happened, I remember them telling me it'd be 10 years, you know, before I found out anything. And I just thought that was just, I could not accept that. I'm like, that is crazy. But so to think it's been almost 7 years since, you know, that happened to Tommy, I feel like I haven't had him for a lifetime, but to think it's really been 7 years, it's unbelievable.
You know, when Tommy was killed, he was in the midst of major searches. He was so dedicated. You know, he was working so hard. Do you think that played a role in his death?
I think his dedication did, you know, because he was so dedicated. I don't think he knew stuff like everybody thought he did. But I think my husband was very well liked. He had a lot of, you know, people he knew and resources, and I think people knew that and they wanted him out of the way, and I honestly think that's what happened. That's why that happened to my husband.
Do you think if he was still alive, he would have found something out? He would have played a key role in getting justice?
I think he would not have given up. I think he wouldn't have given up, and certain people knew that he would not give up.
That's something everyone who knew Tommy agreed with. His steadfast determination to find his missing daughter could not be matched. Many have wondered if that determination played a role in his death. And this statement from the special prosecutor, Shane Young, stirred up even more suspicion.
I will tell Your Honor, we're investigating the murder of Tommy Ballard that could potentially be related to this case. We are waiting for testing to come back on the firearm we believe was used to murder Tommy Ballard, a firearm that we purchased from Nicholas Houck, who was using a fake name when he sold the rifle. We know it's the same caliber. There's 5 criteria that they're looking at, and so far it's matched 4 of the 5 criteria.
Obviously, we were all in the courtroom with some major news just last month. What was going through your mind when you heard that?
I can just say that I'm very happy with the way things are turning out. You know, I can't comment on certain things, but I am very happy with the way things are, with the way things are going.
Was there any moment where that you were surprised, where you caught off guard?
Totally, totally surprised. Totally.
And was it a good surprise?
It was hard, but very good in the end. Very hard.
To me, it feels like, at least publicly, the first time we've had some real acknowledgement of what the investigation looks like for Tommy.
I think so. I think everyone's been working very, very hard, you know, on his investigation. And I think things are coming together. And I think I'm headed in the right direction. After 8-7 years, I'm finally headed in the right direction. I have a good team, you know, I'm in a good place, and now to move forward.
Was that information new to you, or is that what you have always believed?
No, it's what I've always believed. I've said that from day one. You know, I've never, ever changed my mind on that, ever.
So in some ways, it's a little validating.
Very much so, because, you know, people just have to take my word for it. Now it's not just my word. You know, I have something backing me up this time, and it's not just me as a mother or a wife or whatever saying something.
There's more there.
Yeah, so I feel very good about the way things are going.
Of course, now we're waiting. You know, we got this big news. And now we're waiting. What is that wait like for you?
It's better than it was before. A lot better than it was before, because I know I have a direction, you know, to validation. And that means a lot to me. I mean, my husband did not deserve anything that happened to him. And to think finally justice may be around the corner makes me happy.
When you think about what the next few years will be like, it's really a new chapter. You've spent 8 years trying to get investigators to work, to bring evidence, to make arrests. Now we're switching into something different. Are you nervous about what that will look like?
I wouldn't be human if I wasn't nervous. I know a lot I'm going to hear in my husband's case that is going to be very, very hard. Just to hear details and everything. It's going to be very hard for me. But I have not come this far for no reason. So I'm going to push forward, and I'm going to get justice for my husband that he so deserves. And I will get through this.
What do you think life looks like on the other side?
Gosh. I pretty much live day by day just to get me through the day. I know my husband's very happy now. I know he would be right by my side if he could, but I know he's happy with the way things are going.
Gives you some peace.
Yes, it does. And I need peace in my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, Cherry, you have been a pinnacle of strength. You always say that you have no choice, and I know that to be true. But you really have been a pinnacle of strength. You've done an incredible job fighting for your family.
You know, Shay, I just look at my family, and I can't imagine no one not fighting for their family. I can't imagine that. That was never not an option for me. And, you know, you just do that as a wife. I lost a part of me, like my other half. I mean, that he was my other half, and I lost that. How can I not fight for that? There's no other choice.
With so many unsolved cases that go on to become cold cases, that go on to just become this sad story that with no ending, what do you think has made the difference in this one?
I think because I refuse to let that happen, I refused to just let that sit there. That was never an option for me, never. I would have dedicated my whole entire life to find justice for my family. And I would have pushed and pushed. I tried to get every resource I possibly could, you know, and without, so my husband would never be forgotten. And that was just not an option for me.
Sherry says she is strong because she has to be. Because with a missing daughter and murdered husband, what other choice does she have? She also notes her community has given her strength over the years. Strangers turned into supporters, and supporters turned into dear friends.
They've been so good to me, so good to me. I've had so many people come up and just, it's always hard for me to talk about because people are so good to me, you know, and I could have never got through this by myself. And I have such a huge support group that I just want everyone to know that without them, you know, I would not be where I'm at today. And I don't know if I'd had the strength to get up and fight like I have if I didn't have support behind me. And that meant a lot to me. And I just want to thank everyone for that. All the love that they've shown me and just everything they've done. I truly appreciate that.
You have an army behind you.
I don't think I could have got up every morning, Shay, if I had people not believing me, you know, and just thinking, well, you know, she's just a sad mother that, and wife that helped me a lot. And I always want to be appreciative of that.
Sherry has a community standing behind her, demanding justice in her family's cases. It's what makes these cases so unique. They are seemingly known around the state. It's also what makes an upcoming trial so interesting. Is it possible to find a jury that doesn't know about these cases? What about the mass amount of evidence the most attorneys have ever seen? What does that mean? And what are the chances that we'll get to see it? And how does this case tie into the others, like ambush police officer Jason Ellis? Is there a connection there? We have so many questions, so much to consider, and we needed someone who could fill in the gaps. That's where our criminal law expert, Nick Mudd, comes in.
My name's Nick Mudd. I own and operate Mudd Legal Group here in town. I was a prosecutor for 6 years, Jefferson County Commonwealth Attorney's Office here, tried about 50-something cases to a jury, tried about a dozen murder cases there, and was in the violent crimes unit as the assistant deputy, or the deputy to the chief there in the violent crimes unit. Went out on my own in 2016 and have been in private practice since, primarily do criminal defense.
We invited Nick to the WHAS 11 studio to sit down and talk about the case. He has experience in murder investigations, both bringing charges as a prosecutor and defending against them as a criminal defense attorney. So we're talking about the Crystal Rogers case. We now have 3 arrests in this case. We've had several court dates, and we have a lot of questions. These are both questions from our team here at WHAS 11, and also things that the community who follows this case so closely is really curious about. Let's start from the beginning. This was a cold case, some would say, because it went 8 years without any arrests. Of course, we know there were tips. There was search warrants being served. There was searches being done in the public eye, but it was 8 years. What does it take to make an arrest 8 years later?
I will tell you, a cold case is an uphill battle. I mean, there's TV shows about the first 48 hours, 72 hours, et cetera. And that's right. Your most important evidence happens within that time frame of 3 days to, say, a week. As a case goes on, we as criminal defense lawyers like to say the cases get better for us. You know, especially if somebody's charged, they get better for us as time goes on. Most cold cases don't go anywhere after that 24-month period unless, A, you have a forensics that come through, whether it be DNA, which is most common, fingerprints, second most common, or you would have, say, a firearm tool marking that would be traced back to either a bullet or a shell casing that's found. Now, the fourth thing would be, which is much less common, where you have witnesses come forward. Now, that being said, a lot of times prosecutors will not charge with just witnesses alone on cold cases. because of a reliability issue, right? And why did you wait 8 years to come forward? Why did you wait 6 years to come forward? Why are you just now giving a statement? I mean, because that sort of thing, a defense lawyer like myself, we're going to have a field day with on the stand, you know, in front of a jury all day long. Like, you just decided 6 years later to give a statement. Those kind of things are certainly things that juries have trouble convicting people on, and prosecutors know that. And so prosecutors are not in the business to lose cases. They don't want to go forward on cases generally that they know that's going to get in front of a jury, and a jury has a substantial chance of finding someone not guilty.
We're certainly going to dive into some of that witness testimony, because that's a big part of this case. But before we go there, from what you've seen here, do you have any idea what could have been the break in the case for Brooks Houck and Crystal Rogers?
You know, when I saw that they were charged, to me, I thought there had to be forensics. I thought there had to be, whether it's fingerprint, DNA, something with a weapon was located, even, the deceased body was located. That's initially what I thought. However, if things developed, nothing's come out yet. Now, I kept thinking there's got to be some sort of DNA evidence or even cell phone forensics. That's a big thing as well now, is you'll have, you know, a cell phone account tied to an individual, and they'll do what's called triangulation. And so they can go back and pull records, plug it into a program, and it'll spit out, hey, at this point in time, the person was in this general proximity. So far, though, at least that I've seen, and again, I don't have a copy of the discovery, I'm not the attorney on the case, but I've not seen any of that come out, which is surprising.
Would you expect that we would hear some of that by this point in court? Is it normal that so much of it is still sealed and not available to anyone in the public?
I wouldn't say that it's uncommon, but it does surprise me. I figured at some point we would hear about some sort of forensic or physical evidence. Now, we've heard about testimony, right, from the other two individuals besides Mr. Houck that were charged. That being said, you know, given that the fact that it's a cold case, it is very surprising to me that we have not heard about any specific physical evidence that has been brought to light at this point, given that it is a cold case.
Okay, so let's talk about here the specific people who are charged, what they're charged with. We've got Brooks Houck charged with murder and tampering with physical evidence. And then we've got Steve Lawson and Joseph Lawson. They're charged with tampering with physical evidence and conspiracy to commit murder. Can you walk us through these charges and how they might be connected?
Well, certainly, I think Mr. Houck's charges speak for themselves, correct? I mean, it appears that they're probably going forward, obviously, on the murder, but the tampering can be with a body, it can be with a vehicle, it can be with a weapon. There's certainly a wide variety of charges with that. Now, with the other two individuals, the conspiracy, that's not something we see that often in state court. In federal court, you'll often see conspiracy to distribute narcotics, where there's a plan to deliver drugs, etc. But in state court, especially with homicide cases, to be quite honest with you, I've never seen it in a homicide case. In state court, at least in Jefferson County. It's just not something I've ever charged when I was a prosecutor. It's not something I ever dealt with as a defense lawyer. So it is a rare charge, and I'm not sure yet what the hook is on that. Because, you know, there's some question about both Lawson's, you know, the knowledge they had about what was going on. And if you don't know what's going on and you're just doing what you're told, you know, it's hard to say that they were conspiring with Mr. Houck, if that's what the prosecutor is alleging. So I have a lot of questions about those charges specifically. I have not seen a specific bill of particulars which lays out what the prosecutor is factual claim for the charges. But certainly there are a lot of questions regarding those charges, given how rare they are in a state court setting.
So conspiracy would insinuate that they knew about the plan to kill Crystal and they went along with it.
Correct.
That they didn't just participate in something that led to her death without
Correct.
Knowing it would.
Correct. That they knew and that they did some sort of act towards that. You know, you can talk all day about something, but there has to be some sort of affirmative act toward that. And that can be a lot of different things in cases. If somebody provides a weapon, if somebody, you know, provides a date and time and it's about, hey, this provides information of where someone's going to be. I mean, that could be a variety of things that it could be. And so based on what we've seen so far, it leaves a lot of questions, though.
Interesting. Okay, so we know from recent court records, according to Brooks Houck attorney, there is no body, there's no murder weapon, and no motive. This is from Brooks Houck's attorney. What do you think that means? Can we take that as fact? Has he seen the discovery by this point?
Well, certainly, if there was a body or a murder weapon, he can't represent that in a court filing unless that were true. So I think that we can take those two things for fact. He's an officer of the court. Mr. Butler is a phenomenal lawyer, and he's not going to represent something that the discovery says completely otherwise. That being said, the question of whether there's motive, now that's something that could be argued all day long, okay? That's argued in cases every day in trial. You know, my client didn't have a motive. Well, yes, he did. He was a jealous boyfriend. Or yes, he did. They ripped him off in a drug deal. Yes, he did. He stole from my client. You know, that's something that it's a lot more open to interpretation.
How difficult is a prosecutor's job if there's no body and no murder weapon?
I think it becomes extremely difficult because you can't really piece together the past. Okay. And that's part of what a prosecutor does in a trial. They are taking the facts that are before them based on a police officer's investigation or detective investigation, and they're piecing together the past for the jury in order to secure conviction to, you know, prove what happened. And that's how they do it, with evidence. And without a body and without a weapon, it becomes very difficult because you don't have you leaves a lot of questions for a jury when you're asking someone to send someone to prison for the rest of their life. That leaves a lot of questions for them and can leave a jury very uneasy.
How common is a no-body homicide case?
I will tell you, I've never worked one. I've worked dozens of homicides from both sides, and I've never had one where I didn't have a body. So, you know, I can only speak from my experience, but I will tell you that at least in Jefferson County and my experience in surrounding counties, it is very uncommon, very uncommon.
Could that say how strong the evidence is elsewhere for them to bring this case with confidence?
It could, certainly. The fact is, if there's no body and no weapon, then we know that those two pieces of physical evidence, which we have in, you know, 99% of homicides that are charged, certainly it does call into question. Now, that being said, there are certainly convictions that happen without that sort of evidence there. But those cases become very reliant on what's called circumstantial evidence. And a circumstantial case can be often tough to prove for a prosecutor. I've dealt with some cases that were primarily based on circumstantial evidence as a prosecutor, and it is an uphill battle. It is possible, but it's very difficult to go forward on that kind of case.
And do you think ultimately we will get a story of what happened to Crystal? Will the prosecutor present, this is what led to this, this is the motive, this is how she died, this is where she died, this is when she died? Are those details you think we will get in trial?
Absolutely.
Day one of trial, we could be hearing this storyline that people have been waiting, well, at that point, it will be almost 10 years for.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It would have to be. I mean, that's what you do in opening. You summarize, you know, as a prosecutor, you're going to summarize what the jury's going to see, what evidence there is, and really the story that you're selling them on that happened based on that evidence.
Let's talk about the terabyte of evidence that keeps coming up here. Is that a typical amount of evidence in a murder trial? Does that seem like a lot to you?
That is an absurd amount. I mean, that is insane amount. Now, I've had cases upwards of probably 200 to 300 gigabytes, which is about, you know, maybe 20 to 30% of that. But certainly a terabyte is an enormous amount of data. And I think you've even heard the lawyers in court say, Judge, we need more time. We need more time. I have to review this evidence. And, you know, as a defense lawyer, you have a duty to look at everything, because you never know if you turn a page and that page either exonerates your client, or it's a situation to where it's like, hey, this is bad for us and we need to do something about this, or we need to file something. You don't ever want to be blindsided.
And we know in this case, there's so much, I mean, terabyte worth of discovery, but we as the public don't know anything about it. I mean, we have gotten so little when it comes to evidence in this case. We've seen some police interrogation transcripts mm-hmm. that have made their way into court documents here recently, but that's it. Is that unusual to see so little from the file?
I don't think it's entirely unusual. Now, in certain counties, discovery is completely public. So, which means you as the media can go get a copy of the whole file and watch everything. Other counties put everything under seal. And that a lot of times is to protect the victim in a case, their family, et cetera, so that people aren't going through it and then calling them up. In a case like this, given the amount of local, statewide, and even nationwide media exposure, I would say that it's not uncommon for the judge not to want the discovery be distributed to the public.
Do you think we will see it before trial?
I highly doubt that. I would say that, you know, given the nature of the fact that there's already been an agreement that the venue would be prejudicial and the case is going to have to be moved, I doubt that that all of that discovery would be unsealed because of that very reason. Because, you know, more gets out, the more amount of people that can't be fair in this case. Whether they're voting guilty or not guilty, we don't want people looking at evidence on their own, making their own decision. You know, you got to follow the court rules of what the court allows the jury to see and not see. And that's what we want juries to base their decision on. So I do not believe that it will be unsealed prior to trial. Any evidence is going to most likely come out during a jury trial.
Okay, let's talk about trial here. Mm-hmm. First of all, the date, February of 2025. Any chance this trial happens in February of 2025?
5%. I mean, that's what I'd give it at, 1 in 20. Given, again, we go back to the tetrabyte of data, you have motions being filed both sides, multiple sides. You've got not just one defendant, not two, you have three, which means you got three set of lawyers to ask questions. You got three set of lawyers filing motions. You got three sets of lawyers reviewing discovery, asking for other testing be done, etc. I'd say that date could happen, but that would be very aggressive for it likely to happen because I foresee even more motions coming in addition to the ones in June. And things can happen in June. I know there's several motions set then, but what often happens is based on the judge's rulings, defense goes this way, and then you got three lawyers, and another one may go this way and file motions pertaining to other things stemming from those initial rulings from the judge.
So what do you think would be a realistic date for this trial?
Most homicides go on for a minimum of a year, and that's just been my experience from both sides. I've had some go on for upwards of 4 years. I would say the average time for a homicide is probably 20 to 30 months. So I'd say a year and a half to 2 years is not, 2 years is probably the most common, I would say. And that means all your testing's done, all your motions have been filed, you have exhausted every possible way to resolve the case or you know, for a plea, can we come to an agreement? There's mediations that can happen, criminal mediations becoming more and more common. This may not be the case that happens on, but certainly 2 years is probably a good number that I would say is a good average for a typical homicide to get to trial.
So more like fall of 2025.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Okay, you mentioned real quickly plea deals, mediation, things like that. Any chance that this ends that way? It seems like it is so set up for trial.
It does seem highly contentious, certainly. And that's not a fault of any of the parties. Everybody's doing their job and there's great lawyers all around. But certainly, as we've seen with the bond hearings, with the motions being set, typically the more contentious a case is, the higher likely that it is to go to trial. And certainly, given what I call the temperature of the case here, it's a high temperature, which means it's likely to go to trial and not settle.
Location. Big talker in this case. They've thrown out a couple of different spots here in Kentucky, Boyd County, Davis County. Is there anywhere in Kentucky that this trial can move that people are actually not going to know about this case?
And I think you and the media are the best one to answer that question. You know, the more widespread the media is regarding this case, the more people are likely to have prejudged it. And that's the big issue when we deal with juries. And, you know, when we deal with cases that have been on TV and in the news, we don't want jurors to prejudge a case. We want them to come in. We want them to kind of start with a blank slate, and for the system to work, they have to have a blank slate. The prosecutor has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, and certainly the defense lawyer's job is to show that they can't do that and present any mitigating evidence and cross-examine witnesses, etc. Certainly, the more attention the case gets, the less likely that is to happen, but for the system to work, it certainly was smart on all parties' moves to agree to move the venue. I think everyone agreed that, you know, that none of these individuals are going to get a fair trial in Nelson County. And fair being neither would the prosecutor. Everybody's got their, it appears everybody's got a view there within that county about the case. And so certainly I think the farther we move west, the more likely I would assume that people will have a little bit more of a blank slate regarding the case. But for everybody, and that includes the prosecutor and the defense, for everybody to get a fair trial, we need jurors with a blank slate who have not formed any sort of opinion at all about the case or about the evidence.
You know, I can tell you from my social media, I have followers who follow me because they want to know what's happening in Crystal's case from all parts of not only Kentucky, but the country. Would you be worried about this if you were representing one of these defendants? Would you be worried about how difficult it's going to be to find someone who hasn't heard anything, who really is open to being that blank slate?
If I was on it, absolutely, unless they're voting for my client to be not guilty. But yeah, I mean, it's a concern here. It's a huge concern.
So you think, whereas in a typical homicide here in Louisville, 60 people, you'll find your jurors.
Absolutely.
You think we're talking to hundreds in this case?
Yes, absolutely, at least. And we better be very far west.
Yeah, to try to find people who haven't heard about it or don't have the opinion.
Or far east, I guess. It depends on how far you want to travel.
It's on the table, Boyd County.
Or somewhere, Boyd County, yeah, somewhere like that might be a great idea.
Boyd County's on the table, so we'll see. Okay, so we know prosecutors want all three defendants tried together in this case. They are trying to combine them. Every single defense attorney has filed an objection to that. Can you walk us through the motivation on both sides?
Right. Well, as a defense, I'll start with the prosecutors. The prosecutor, you don't want to try three cases, right? I mean, that's three times you got to get the same detective, the same witnesses, the same forensics people, the same lab people. And, you know, as trials go on, the third defendant is in the best position because he's already heard the trial twice. He knows what everybody's going to say. He's getting, you know, transcriptions of everything that was said, and he's licking his chops saying, I'm waiting for you to mess up. And even if somebody's telling the truth, it's difficult to say the exact same thing under oath twice in a row. The general story may be the same, but, you know, our job as lawyers is to pick things apart. That's what we do. And certainly, if I'm going third and I've gotten two prior sworn testimonies of somebody, I'm going to find inconsistencies. And what does that do? It leads juries to start questioning people's veracity and their truthfulness, even if the person's trying their best to tell the truth. So as a prosecutor, you don't want to try three cases. And it's stressful for families. You know, for the family of Crystal Rogers to have to go through three trials would be gut-wrenching, I imagine. You know, my heart goes out to them, but certainly it would be definitely devastating to a family to have to go through the same thing over and over. And these trials are not quick. We're talking 2 to 4 week trials at least, given the amount of, you know, tetrabyte of data. We don't know how many witnesses that may lead to on the stand. And certainly with the jury selection, you know, now we filtered out one jury. Do we need to move to another county? And we've got another jury there. Do we need to, you see what I mean? And then this could really blossom into something that goes on and on and on if there were three jury trials. Now, from the defense perspective, the reason why you generally want to be severed is I don't want to be tied to the guy next to me. You know, whatever he did, I don't want to be tied to him. The guy out here, I don't want to be tied to him. And that's kind of how that evidence, if you got one defendant, okay, but being tried, and there's two co-defendants, the information about the two co-defendants is generally considered irrelevant and a judge would exclude it. And so you do your best to exclude that as a defense lawyer. You don't want that stuff coming in, right? And so you don't want to be sitting next to the guy if bad stuff's coming in on him, because you're sitting next to him. The prosecutor's saying, those are all three together. And, you know, if you're tried alone, you have a much better argument of keeping that stuff out as irrelevant. You know, if you're being tried by yourself, you say, Judge, that goes to another defendant. That has nothing to do with my client. And a judge will typically agree under the rules. When you're all together, they hear everything. And, of course, the prosecutor's going to do a great job of painting them as a team, okay? That, hey, I know you only heard he did this and he did this, but they're a team. They're all together. And so certainly a prosecutor rarely, if ever, wants to sever defendants, and a defense lawyer almost rarely, if ever, wants to be with their co-defendant, if that makes sense.
So what do you think, where will the judge land here? Because there certainly is a case on both sides where the prosecutor is saying the time, the resources, the effort, if we're moving this across the state of Kentucky, absolutely. Can we defend the cost of taxpayers three different times? And then you have the defense attorneys. Brian Butler just filed a really powerful motion where he's laying out a lot of different reasons why he wants them to be separate. Where do you think the judge ends up?
I don't know. But my experience has been judges are very reluctant to sever defendants. They're very reluctant to allow three trials to happen with three co-defendants or two trials with two co-defendants. There has to be a very, very, very compelling reason. And, you know, this is not the kind of case that I see them severing. Judicial economy and judicial resources are something that the court strongly factors in. And certainly, if there's evidentiary questions, then a lot of times what the judge will do is say, hey, if you guys want to be, you know, Mr. Prosecutor, if you want to try these cases together, then X, Y, and Z evidence isn't coming in because it's only applies to this defendant, or you're not allowed to argue that it applies to the other defendant. So there's a lot of limitations a judge could do, but judges are very reluctant to sever defendants, okay? And a lot of that has to do with the fact of judicial economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, us having to call the same witnesses over and over and over as taxpayers, you know, as citizens. And so I doubt that the case will be severed, the defense will be severed. But that being said, I think the judge is in the best position to make that. I think Judge Sims will make the right call regardless.
The motion to combine the cases is just one of many sitting on Judge Sims' desk right now. Also up for consideration, a request from Steve Lawson and his attorney, Ted Lavitt. He claims his client should have immunity by promise of the prosecutor, and he's filed a motion to have the charges against him dropped.
At all times, he was promised immunity, in my presence and outside of my presence, before I got involved and after I got involved. And there's no question about that.
That's attorney Ted Lavitt after the most recent court hearing, explaining he was with police when they promised his client immunity in exchange for the truth. And he says his client told them the truth, just not a truth investigators wanted to hear.
He said, this is the truth. This is all I know. I can't say what you're wanting me to say. I'm telling you what I know. And he did.
So what could come from this? Will the judge drop the charges? And if so, what does that mean for his testimony? Will the prosecutor be able to use it? Plus, could another arrest in the Houck family be on the way? Nick Mudd weighs in next time on Bardstown. The Bardstown Podcast is a WHAS 11 News production. It's written by me, Shay McAllister, and edited by WHAS 11 Chief Photojournalist Philip Merle. You can visit our website, WHAS11.com, to learn more about the cases and see exclusive visual elements that help explain everything we've talked about today.